You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. When I present our program, Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, with your host, Roy Showman.
Hi, this is Roy Showman, and welcome once again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and her sacraments. Now, it's been a while since I have actually given my own witness testimony on the show. If you listen regularly, you'll know that is one of my favorite things to do, is to have other Jewish entrants into the Catholic Church on the show to tell how the veil was removed from their eyes and they came to recognize that Jesus was indeed, is indeed, the long-promised Jewish Messiah. And so I thought I would use today's show to actually play a recent witness testimony that I gave at a parish mission. And my plan is to stop about halfway through to take any calls. So if you call, if you have any questions or comments, I suggest that you call in at about 25 minutes past the hour. The number here is 866-333-6279. Or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. And I'll be happy to take the calls and answer your questions before going back to the witness testimony. And so I'll just begin that recording of that witness testimony in a few moments. It's up, by the way, in video on YouTube if you're interested. At the end of the show, I'll give that address. And also, let me just say before I begin that another thing that I'd really like to do is lead pilgrimages to the Holy Land, Catholic pilgrimages with a little flavor of Old Testament, also the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith and the elements of Old Testament pilgrimage sites. For instance, the Jacob's Well and perhaps the Tomb of Joseph or the Tomb of the Patriarchs and so forth in Israel while we're there also. And we still do have some spaces left on the pilgrimage, which is going shortly after Easter in 2018. It leaves on April 17th, running to the 28th. And if you're interested in finding out more about it, I suggest sending me an email. The easiest email address to remember is haveroytalk@gmail.com. So it's just haveroytalk@gmail.com. And if you send me email, I'll be happy to send you the brochure and any necessary information for finding out more. But with that, let me play this witness testimony and of me and how I came to be, to go from being a arrogant young Jewish Harvard Business School professor to being whatever it is that I am now, but certainly somebody who has their eye to maximizing my bank account in heaven rather than on earth. So with that, let me go to the witness testimony. And as I said, I will end it where I will interrupt it in about 20 minutes if there are any calls that come in before going back to it. So here we are now.
So without further ado, Roy Showman.
Hi. Thank you all for coming. And I'm very, very happy to be here. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be able to share my witness testimony. Let me just start at the beginning. I was born and raised Jewish. My parents are both German-Jewish Holocaust refugees. They were both born and raised in Germany. My father left Germany shortly after Hitler came to power. There was a period when Hitler was actually trying to get the Jews to leave as long as they left everything behind. And he left as a young man at that point and made it to the United States. My mother's family was less fortunate. They fled to France. But France soon fell under the Third Reich, and my mother was actually arrested by the Gestapo and put on a train to a concentration camp, but managed to escape and make it to the United States eventually, where she met my father, and they married. I was raised outside of New York City. My whole world growing up was Jewish. In those days, there was less mixing between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. And so all of my parents' friends were Jewish. All of my friends were Jewish. I went to Jewish religious education all the way from the beginning of school in first grade until university alongside secular education. And in the summer, actually my late high school years, I became even more devoutly Jewish, and I became a follower of a Hasidic rabbi. You know the Hasids, the Jews with the long ear curls and the fur-brimmed black hats and so forth. And I kind of became a disciple of his, and I spent the summer between high school and college actually living with him and traveling with him in Israel in his entourage. And I toyed with the idea, in fact, of not coming back to the United States and beginning university that fall, but staying in Israel and entering the closest thing that Judaism has to religious life, which is a life of study and prayer in a yeshiva in Jerusalem. But I didn't. I came back to the United States, and I began university that fall. It was MIT. And in my university years is when I really lost my Jewish faith. And by the time I left university, I was essentially atheist. I lost my faith at college under two influences. One was the pseudoscientific worldview that somehow religion is a medieval superstition that man made up to give him answers before he had science, which provides him with real answers to everything. And everything that science doesn't have the answer to today, it will in 5 years. I call that a pseudoscientific worldview. In fact, it's the opposite of genuine science, because the heart of science is you start with the evidence, you start with the data, and you develop a theory that explains the data. And if it successfully explains the data, you can hold on to the theory. And if not, you have to discard that theory and find another one that can explain the evidence, that can explain the data. And in fact, all of the evidence is for the truths of the Catholic faith. There's lots and lots of scientific evidence that supports the Catholic faith. You only have to think of, even if you don't believe the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, you have the fact of the tilma, right, of Juan Diego's tilma, which is made of, out of cactus cloth that has a 20 or 30 year life. It dates from the early 16th century. It's been around for 500 years. There is no, there's no paint on it that provides the image. There's no materialistic explanation for the image on the tilma of Guadalupe, just like there's no materialistic explanation for the Shroud of Turin, the image on the Shroud of Turin, which is also has no pigmentation, no paint, somehow miraculously produced. And even today, with all of today's technology, science couldn't counterfeit the Shroud of Turin. They'd be totally helpless. You have the miracle at Fatima, where the sun was seen to spin in the sky and crash to earth, seen by 70 to 100,000 witnesses, including atheists and skeptics and communists who had just come there to make fun of the ignorant peasants who thought a miracle would happen, but they saw it nonetheless, and so forth and so on. There's lots and lots of documented materialistic scientific evidence for the truths of the Catholic faith that materialism has no explanation for. So if one were to be true to the scientific attitude, one would have to throw away the materialistic hypothesis or theory or whatever in favor of a belief in God and, in fact, a belief in a lot of aspects of Catholicism. G.K. Chesterton has a very appropriate quote. I think many of you have heard of G.K. Chesterton. He was a British Christian writer of the first half of the 20th century. And he wrote, "Rightly or wrongly, those who believe in miracles believe in them on the basis of the evidence. Rightly or wrongly, those who disbelieve in miracles refuse to believe in them on the basis of faith." Right? So it's exactly the opposite of this attitude that was inculcated in me at MIT, but I didn't know that at the time, and I actually bought that materialistic worldview. So by the time I got out of there, I was essentially atheist. I went on to Harvard Business School. I did well enough there that I was invited upon graduation to join the faculty of Harvard Business School as a professor of marketing. So I found myself at the ripe old age of 29, a newly minted professor of marketing at Harvard Business School. And that's really where my witness testimony begins, because what had been going on is that all my life since I was a small child, I felt there has to be a real meaning and purpose to life. And someday when I'm older, I'll come to know the real meaning and purpose to life. And as a child, I thought that would come from entering into a personal relationship with God, which I honestly thought would happen at my bar mitzvah. The bar mitzvah is like the Jewish version of Catholic confirmation. When the child is 13, there's a ceremony in the synagogue where he reads from the Torah for the first time. He enters into religious adulthood. And I honestly thought that at my bar mitzvah, the veil would drop and I would enter into a personal relationship with God. And when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days of my childhood. But then pretty soon, I decided that the real meaning and purpose of life would come when I got a driver's license, or when I left home, or when I got a girlfriend, or when I began MIT, or if I got into Harvard Business School, or when I began my career, and so forth. But here I was already far more successful in a secular career than I ever expected to be, being a professor at Harvard Business School. But life still had no meaning or purpose. But the difference was at this point that now there was nothing more I could look forward to in the future that I might imagine might give my life meaning and purpose, because there was no other greater success out there that I could imagine would give my life the meaning it didn't have. So I actually fell into the deepest despair of my life at that point, kind of existential despair. Life had no meaning. We're just a chemical accident. Lightning hit an amino acid soup 5 billion years ago, and somehow we sprang out of it, and we live for 80 or 90 or 100 years, and then we die, and that's it, and just no meaning or purpose to anything. And it was in that despair that I received the single most spectacular grace of my life. I was walking early one morning in a beautiful spot of nature. At the time, I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and this happened on Cape Cod. Cape Cod, I don't know, some of you, I'm sure, know of it, but it's a lot of it is national seashore. It's a beautiful little spit of land that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean with a lot of sand dunes and pine woods and so forth. And I was just alone in a nature preserve there, walking in the, like, low pine woods behind the sand dunes early one morning, lost in my thoughts, long since having given up on any idea of God, when from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven disappeared, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life as I would see it after I died and was looking back over my life in the presence of God. And I saw everything and I understood everything in the way I would in the presence of God after death. And I saw that my two greatest regrets after I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that it was all true, that we live forever, that every action has a moral content that is observed and recorded and weighed in the balance and recorded for all eternity, that every right decision we make, every right moral action that we make is will very literally be benefiting us for all eternity, and every lost opportunity, every moment in which we don't do something that we could do that's of value in the eyes of heaven, would be a lost opportunity for all eternity. I saw how wrong I had been all my life. I had kind of been living my life looking in the rearview mirror, saying to myself, if only that hadn't happened to me, then I would be happy today. Or if only that hadn't happened to me, then I would be happy today. And that nothing could be further from the truth, that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from the hands of an all-knowing, all-loving God, not only including those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, that I had thought of as the greatest disasters at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering at the time. I saw, and this was by far the most astounding single aspect of this experience, the most moving single aspect, I saw that not only had this God, the God who created, not only created all that exists, but created existence itself, been watching over me every moment of my life since conception and controlling everything that happened to me at every moment to be the most perfect thing that could happen to me, but that he had known how I was feeling at every moment and cared about how I was feeling at every moment to the point that in a very real way he was made happy by everything that made me happy and was made sad by everything that made me sad, and he had been watching over me and caring about me every moment of my existence as though I were the only creature he had ever created, as though I was the purpose of all of creation. And to come into that awareness, this had nothing to do with my understanding of God, being Jewish growing up. Just to come into that awareness was the most earth-shattering aspect of this experience. At the time that this happened, all my life growing, I mean, I did not know growing up what cradle Catholics know just from the Penny Catechism growing up. So this was all entirely new to me. I didn't even know this in theory. The picture of God that I had from Judaism was the picture of God that emerges from the Old Testament. Now I know that is the same God, but in all honesty, if you read the Old Testament, the picture of God that emerges is of a picture, as of a God far more distant and severe and judgmental than this God was. And in fact, God in the days of the Old Testament didn't deal with ordinary people, didn't deal with the hoi polloi, but he only spoke to the people through the priests and prophets. In fact, there's a prophecy, I believe it's in the book of Joel, it's repeated in the book of Acts, where the Lord says, the day will come when you won't have to run to these people and ask them, tell me about God, tell me about God, tell me about God, because I'll make myself known to the lowliest manservant and maidservant. That's the God we have now. That is the revelation of God and the relationship between God and man that came about through Christ. But it wasn't there in the days of the Old Testament. So I could not put together this God who was showing himself to me with the God that I had the way I had thought of God from Judaism. I saw that how foolish I had been to think that life has no meaning and purpose. In fact, every moment has this infinite depth of meaning because it has the potential for an action with a moral content which matters to heaven and which matters to us for all eternity. Now, at the time, I was a Harvard Business School marketing professor, so I have some excuse for having been entirely selfish because that's really a science of selfishness, right? And that's what Harvard Business School is all about. And everything was net present value and maximizing returns and all of that. And during this experience, I saw that not only all my life had I been selfish, and I didn't even during this experience realize that I had been wrong to be selfish all my life, but what I saw during this experience was not only had I been selfish all my life, but I had not only been selfish, but I had been stupid and selfish because I had been putting all of my time and energy into things which wouldn't be doing me any good at all, even 100 years from now after I'm dead. And if I want to be smart and selfish, the only thing that made sense was to try to be as great a saint as possible and build up as much treasure in heaven as possible, right? So the picture that I had at the time was it's as though I had spent all my life striving to accumulate this big pile of brightly colored Monopoly money when there was this huge pile of solid gold coins right next to it that I had been ignoring, which would be treasure in heaven. I'm just trying to think of what I should talk about. While this experience was happening, I was still walking during this experience. I still saw the physical world around me, but behind, it's like the physical world had become this semi-transparent veil. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes if you go to the theater, I know I've had this when I go to the ballet, sometimes you'll be there, you'll be in the theater, the house lights will be on, there'll be a curtain in front of the stage, and you just see the front of the curtain. And then the house lights will go down, they'll shine spotlights on the front of the curtain, you'll still just see the curtain. And then they'll dim the spotlights on the front of the curtain, and they'll raise the stage lights behind the curtain, and all of a sudden this curtain becomes almost transparent, and you see the actors on the stage, or you see the dancers on the stage. And that's what this was like. It was like, I still saw the physical world around me, but it had become almost transparent and inconsequential. And behind it, I saw the spiritual world, which was really the solid thing and the real thing and the thing that mattered. And while this was happening, I wasn't surprised that I could see the spiritual world behind the physical world. The only thing that surprised me was that I could ever have been blind to it and not seen it, because it was so much more real and more solid and more substantial than this physical world. And it never occurred to me that I could ever become blind to it again. So I was still walking, and so I prayed as I walked, because of course by now I knew that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God, who was revealing himself to me and who had watched over me with such tender loving care and so forth. And so I prayed, let me know your name so I know what religion to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. And I very literally prayed that, and I think that some of you may understand where that was coming from, but it's the attitude that I had grown up with, that I almost got with my mother's milk, that Christianity was the great enemy of the Jews, that it was the cause of all of the persecution of the Jews for the last 2,000 years, and so forth. And anyway, he respected that prayer, and he didn't reveal his name to me, and obviously I wasn't ready to hear it, or I wouldn't have said it. But I went back home. The state of awareness, the state of consciousness, slowly faded. It faded when I started running across other people. The morning was going on, of course, and as it got later, some other, my paths would cross with other people and so forth. And each time I crossed the paths with another person, like my state of consciousness, would drop a notch. And so the state of awareness faded slowly. But I went back home to Cambridge, happy for the first time since childhood. I knew it was all true. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was never any reason to be anxious about anything. I knew that there was this infinite meaning and purpose to life. And I basically just immediately transformed my Harvard Business School selfishness into a kind of pseudo-Catholic selfishness of wanting to amass as much treasure in heaven as possible and do everything I could to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God who had revealed himself to me. I instantly lost interest, by the way, in teaching Harvard MBAs how to make a little more money. And over the course of the next few years, I was no longer quite as welcome at Harvard Business School as I had been. But so I got back home, happy for the first time since childhood, walking on air. You guys don't know, I hope you don't know because you grew up Catholic, but, it's hard to even imagine what it's like to really believe that life has no meaning or purpose, that we live for 70 or 80 years, we die, and that's it. And that's the situation almost everyone else out there is in. Compared to that, I had to be walking on air. Compared to that, I can't put it in words, but nothing else mattered. And as a matter of fact, nothing else does matter, by the way. I'll tell you a secret. We live forever. We are going to live for all eternity. 100 million years from now won't be a drop in the bucket. That is true. What that 100 million years or 100 billion years or all eternity is going to be like is going to be fixed in concrete at the moment we die. It is going to be determined by how we spend this very short period on Earth, this 60 or 70 or 80 or 100 or maybe 110 years on Earth, blink of an eye. But what we do in that 100 years is going to define our eternity. It is going to define our state for more than hundreds and millions of years. And, please God, we all make it to heaven. But even if we all make it to heaven, our enjoyment of heaven is going to be perfect relative to ourselves. But our enjoyment of heaven is not going to be equal with everyone else in heaven. Everyone in heaven has a different degree of glory. And I just came across yesterday a beautiful quote from St. Faustina from her diary, which I forgot again to bring tonight. You know St. Faustina's diary? She lived, she was a Polish nun. She had a lot of visions of Jesus who spoke to her. And in one of her diary entries, she thanks Jesus for having shown her the different degrees of glory of the saints in heaven. And she said, thank you, Jesus, for showing this to me. I now understand I would undergo all of the sufferings of all of the martyrs in history combined in order to earn one more degree of glory in heaven. Okay? I'm still showing the selfishness, right? But it's not entirely bad. It doesn't make any sense to really trade anything that's going to benefit us for all eternity for anything that's going to benefit us for the next 20 or 30 years at most. It's very bad business. It's a very bad net present value calculation. Take it from a Harvard Business School professor. So anyway, all I wanted to do was pursue this experience and know who this God was and know how to follow him. I didn't think he was Christ. I was still anti-Christian at the time. So all I could do, well, I did one thing. As soon as I got back home, I wanted to find a mystic to talk to, because I had this mystical experience. I didn't even know mystical experiences existed at the time that this happened. And so I just wanted to find a mystic to talk to who I thought could shed some light on this and tell me who this God was. So I found this self-styled mystic. He was actually a fallen away Catholic. I made an appointment to see him, so hoping he could shed some light on this. And so I went over to his apartment one evening, and he led me on all kinds of silly wrong paths. He was into all kinds of New Age stuff and gave me all kinds of, silly New Age books to read. But one good thing happened when I was in his apartment, which was at one point he went in the kitchen to make us a cup of tea and left me alone in the living room. And on his coffee table, he had this big coffee table picture book called something like The 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times. And I just leafed through the book while I was waiting for him to come back with the tea. And my eyes fell on a page dedicated to the miracle of Fatima. So when he came back with the tea, I point to that page and I say to him, did this really happen? And he says, oh, yes. And so my next question was, has anyone else ever heard of it? Here I had spent 23 years in school. No one had ever told me about the miracle of Fatima. So then he said, oh, yeah, every Catholic knows about it. So then I asked him, has anything else been written about it? And he said, oh, yeah, just go to the public library. You'll find a dozen books on Fatima. Well, my initial reaction was to be filled with furious indignation. I felt, how could they have kept this secret from me? I felt my whole life would have been different if I had known that miracles still happen. All my time growing up in Jewish religious education, I kept pestering the teachers, asking them, why did God used to perform miracles in the days of the Old Testament and no longer does? And they never had an answer. I felt, and I know, my life would have been different had I known that miracles still happen. And so, I mean, I think that we are living in this pseudoscientific age, as I said. Everybody wants proofs to believe. Everybody wants something, you know, some kind of scientific evidence before they accept something. God has given us in our day a particular wealth of scientific evidence supporting the faith of the Catholic, the truth of the Catholic faith, including things like the miracle of Fatima, as I said, seen by over 70,000 people, things like the Shroud of Turin, things like the Marian apparitions, things like the Our Lady of Guadalupe and the Tilma, things like the medical miracles at Lourdes, you know, all of which, what really qualifies as scientific evidence supporting the truths of the faith. And I'm not here, you know, to yell at cradle Catholics or beat up on you, but the one thing that I think one could beat up on cradle Catholics a little bit about is not sharing the faith enough. Obviously, the spirit of the world doesn't want you to share the faith. The spirit of the world, i.e. the devil, has really only one interest, which is keeping people away from God and keeping people away from the faith. And the lie that he's spreading today is, okay, this may be fine for you, but you have no right to impose it on others. You know, you don't want to make them feel bad. You don't want to act triumphalistic. I mean, it's an embarrassing situation to have the truth that everybody else wants to have and thinks they have, and for you to really have it and for them to not have it. I grant that's embarrassing, but it's no excuse for not sharing it, because you have what everybody else in the world is dying for. And all you have to do is, you know, go out on the sidewalk and look at the people covered with tattoos from neck to ankles, or look at the people, you know, drugged out on the sidewalk, or listening to, you know, to heavy metal music, or just in this kind of normal daily despair of dragging themselves to work and dragging themselves home and so forth. You know, the only people who have any ability to genuinely be happy and at peace in the world today are people in right relationship with God, and that really does mean Catholics in a state of grace. And we have all of, I mean, we have all of the truths, we have all of the answers to the things that torture everybody else. What's the meaning of life? What happens after we die? Why is there suffering? That, by the way, which I'll talk about more in a later talk, the question, if there's a good, all-powerful God, why is there so much suffering? That has everybody else in the world in despair. And only the Catholic faith, and not even the other Christian denominations, has the answer, and really has the answer, to the mystery of suffering. And the fact that the existence of suffering does not disprove God, and not only does not remove the meaning of our lives, but actually gives our lives the ultimate meaning, right? I mean, Padre Pio used to say, God forgive me for repeating this, but Padre Pio used to say, if we knew the true value of suffering, we would never pray for anything else. Okay? And these are things that you know as, you know, as Catholics and as kind of somewhat in touch Catholics. And I was in despair, even being a Harvard Business School marketing professor, I was in despair, in some sense, considering suicide just because of the meaningless and pointlessness of life. I didn't mean to mention this, but I actually have a weekly radio program that is on Saturdays from 3 to 4. And I just had this coming Saturday, I have an interview with a Buddhist that I met, a young Buddhist man, who similarly was considering suicide just out of the lovelessness and meaninglessness of life when he had a revelation of Christ. And he's now also an extremely enthusiastic Catholic and so forth. So anyway, don't keep it secret, and don't think that you're not the greatest favor you can ever do to anybody is to share your faith with them. And you don't have to beat them over the head with it, and you don't have to be telling them, and I know that you wouldn't tell them, you know, you're wrong and I'm right. All you have to do is let them know what you have, what you subjectively experience from your faith, the consolation you get from receiving communion, the consolation you get from Eucharistic adoration, the feeling of peace you get from praying the rosary, your sense of communion with the Blessed Virgin Mary and her love and how that gives you peace, the reason why you're peaceful in the presence of bad news, of a bad medical report, of the death of someone you love, because you understand what waits for you and you understand the meaning of life, you understand God's love. If you just let them know what you experience from the Catholic faith, whether they admit it or not, and they probably won't admit it, they will want what you have, and it'll plant a seed. It may take 10 or 20 or 30 years to germinate, but it will plant a seed which won't go away and which might result in them actually coming into right relationship with God. And it actually might make the difference, at least in some case, of the difference between them being saved or them being lost forever.
Let me interrupt at that point. This is Roy again. You're listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. And I've been playing a witness testimony that I gave, which I will go back to in a moment or two. But first, let me say this is live, despite the fact that I'm playing a tape. So if you want to call in with any questions or comments, the number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. And we did get a caller who asked a question. It's a little bit of an inside baseball question, but I did mention that I had gone to MIT, and this caller mentioned that he had seen online that I had studied linguistics there and asked me if I have any thoughts about Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, who is a very, very, very famous linguist who was teaching at MIT while I was there. And the very short answer is that I did take a course or two from him, but not directly in linguistics. He also taught something along the lines of politics. He's very politically active, very hardcore left wing. And frankly, so was I in those days. So I took a course, at least one course from him on that. And I did have some interaction with him around linguistics, but nothing serious. I was an undergraduate and he was a, you know, superstar professor. And the caller asked if I have any thoughts about him. I certainly am extremely dismissive of his politics, which I think are actually over the edge into lunacy. And even his linguistics, this isn't a show for linguistics, but he made his name by developing this new concept called structural linguistics, which I believe has essentially been disproven since then. It was an elegant theory which did not, unfortunately, correspond with reality. So anyway, I just want to be faithful to the promise to take calls and to answer questions. No other call has come in the minute or two that I spent answering that last call. So, by the way, if the caller wants anything more on Chomsky, he's more than welcome to send me an email. Again, haveroytalk@gmail.com, and I'll go into it a little bit more, but this is probably not the setting for discussing linguistics. So let me return to the witness testimony.
You know the parable of Divas, of the rich man and Lazarus, which was about 2 months ago, actually. It was in the mass readings. But you all know the story. The rich man, who's usually called Divas, who feasted at his table and had food overflowing and more food than he knew what to do with, and, you know, the food rolling off the edges of his table, and Lazarus, the poor man, the beggar, who was starving to death outside of his door, and Divas would not share any of his excess food even with this beggar. And so when they both died, Lazarus, the beggar, went to the bosom of Abraham, and the rich man was lost. And usually that parable is thought of in terms of the riches of this world, and that's perfectly appropriate, but it may be even more appropriate to think of it in terms of spiritual riches, and in particular the riches of your faith, the riches of the Catholic Church, because a Catholic in the state of grace really is that rich man feasting at this tremendous banquet table day after day after day, and everybody else really is that starving beggar outside the door with the dog licking his wounds, dying and maybe even being lost for not having what you have. And we're all going to be called to account someday. We're all going to die. We're all going to be in the presence of Jesus, seeing our life like unfold before us, you know, like a movie, reviewing our lives. And we'll see incident after incident after incident. And the one incident that none of us want to see is where Jesus shows us, like, do you remember, like, when you were on that airplane and you started to say your rosary, but you were afraid the guy next to you would think you're nuts, so you hid it under your coat? I can say this because I did this, actually. You hid this under your coat so that he wouldn't notice. Well, you were the one person I sent to him to start a conversation which would have put him on the right path, and you were afraid of being embarrassed, and as a result, he was lost. And we don't want to see that when we review our lives in the presence of Jesus. We don't know, but there is nothing. I mean, I this doesn't even have to be said, but there's nothing we could possibly do in our lives which would be of as much value to God, as much value to Jesus, as influencing somebody so they end up in heaven instead of in hell. We're not going to do that if we're afraid of what people think of us. We're not going to do that if we listen to that voice whispering in our ear saying, oh, no, you don't want to say that to them. You might offend them. You might make them feel bad. And I'm saying this also as a Jew because the people are afraid of being anti-Semitic. Well, there is no greater anti-Semitism than refusing to evangelize the Jews, not sharing the Jewish Messiah, Jesus, the greatest gift that ever came to mankind, which came to the rest of the world through the Jews, to withhold him from the Jews by refusing to evangelize the Jews or refusing to share the faith with the Jews. But this was all a big digression. And where on earth was I? Oh, yeah, I was at this guy's apartment seeing the miracle of Fatima. So anyway, so I leave his apartment with all this unhealthy stuff, but with the miracle of Fatima in the back of my head. And then what I was doing after that first experience was every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer that I had made up to know the name of my Lord and Master and God who had revealed himself to me in that first experience. And a year to the day after that first experience, and I know that it was a year to the day because I remember praying a prayer of thanksgiving before going to sleep for what had happened a year earlier, I went to sleep, and I thought I was woken by a hand on my shoulder. Now I understand that my body was still asleep in bed, and if there was a camera in the room, it would have shown me sleeping in bed. But I experienced it as though I was awakened, and my memory represents it as though I was awake. So I can only describe it as I experienced it, which was that I was woken up by a hand on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And just to be in her presence, just to feel the purity and the intensity of the love that flowed from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I ever imagined could exist. And as beautiful as she was to look at, and as moving as that was, even more powerfully affecting was the sound of her voice, the beauty of her voice, which carried the essence of music, whatever makes music music. And it just flowed through me, carrying this essence of music and pure love, and it just lifted my soul up to the state of ecstasy. And when I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately. The first thing she said to me was she offered to answer any questions that I might have for her. The first thought that crossed my mind was to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary, because I just wanted to honor her somehow appropriately. But I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it, so instead, as a kind of indirect way of getting her to teach it to me, I asked her what her favorite prayer to her was. Now, her initial response was somewhat coy. It was, "I love all prayers," to me. But I was a little bit pushy. Maybe that's because I'm a New York Jew, and maybe not. But I said, "But you must love some prayers to you more than others." And she relented, and she recited a prayer. But it was in Portuguese, and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember the first few syllables phonetically. And the next morning when I woke up, I wrote them down phonetically. And later, when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all of the Marian prayers in Portuguese so I could try to identify it. And to the best of my ability, I identified it as, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us, have recourse to thee." I asked her about five or six other questions. I remember the feeling of standing there, weighing different questions in my mind. You know, what about this? What about that? That's stupid. I won't ask that. Oh, that's not too bad. I'll ask that. I'll mention the better questions now. Some of them were pretty embarrassing. Most of the questions came out of this sense of being overwhelmed by who she was and just wanting to honor her somehow. By the way, I will say, she spoke to me. I mean, I heard her voice, her answers, her spoken answers, but there were also things that just flowed into my mind, a kind of intellectual vision that came during this experience. And the first experience also, by the way, was intellectual vision. It was just things presented inside my mind. So the fact that she was the Blessed Virgin Mary was something that she never said out loud, but I just knew when I was, you know, found myself in her presence. Anyway, so out of this desire to somehow honor her, at one point, it was more of an exclamation than actually a question, but I said, "How can it be? How is it possible? How can it be that you're so glorious, that you're so magnificent, that you're so exalted? How can it be?" And her response was just to look down at me almost pityingly and shake her head gently. And she said, "Oh no, you don't understand. You don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything." And then again, out of this desire to somehow honor her appropriately, I asked her what her favorite title for herself was. And her response was, "I am the beloved daughter of the Father, mother of the Son, and spouse of the Spirit." And then maybe this is the last question and answer I'll mention, but by now I figured out if this was the Blessed Virgin Mary, it had been Christ in that earlier experience, and this was all about Christianity, and I'd better get up to speed pretty quick. And all my life I had heard the expression the Holy Spirit, and I didn't have any idea what it meant. So I apologize for the way I phrased this, but I didn't know any better. I said to her, "What's this business about the Holy Spirit?" And her response was just to look upwards with an expression melting with love and say, "He's his gaze." A number of years later, when I told this to some seminarian friends of mine, they pointed out that St. Thomas Aquinas had called the Holy Spirit the look of love that passes between the Father and the Son. Now, I will say, when I went to sleep that night before this experience, I had no idea, I had knew virtually nothing about the Blessed Virgin Mary. I had never opened up a New Testament. All I knew about the Blessed Virgin Mary was from Christmas carols, mostly from Silent Night, and that line, "round young virgin," I thought referred to her being pregnant, that she was a round young virgin. This was all entirely new to me. The next morning when I woke up, she answered all the questions I had for her. After the questions and answers, she said she had something else she wanted to speak to me about, and she spoke to me for about another 10 or 12 minutes. There's a veil over that part of the experience. I don't have the kind of word-for-word memory of it that I have of the first part of the experience. And then the audience was over. I went back to sleep. The next morning when I woke up, I was hopelessly in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary. I knew that I had been Christ in that initial experience. I knew that I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely Christian as possible. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the difference was between a Protestant and a Catholic. There wasn't much I could do other than open a local phone book and find a church to go to, which was a Protestant church. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But anyway, The next morning when I woke up, my first thought when I woke up was, oh boy, I can't wait until I go back to sleep again tonight and see her again. I honestly thought that it would happen. When it didn't happen, I said to myself the next morning, oh well, it's bound to happen at least once a week. Of course it didn't happen, then at least once a month. By the time I realized it would never happen again, the experience had faded to the point where I could accept, the rest of life going on, living another 60 or 70 years without ever seeing her again. But if I had woken up the morning after that experience and known that I would have had to go 70 years stuck on Earth without ever seeing her again, I don't know how I could have faced it. It was like vibrant three-dimensional color versus, you know, flat black and white cardboard world. The love and the intensity of existence in her presence. So I really think it was a great grace that I did not understand that at the time that it wouldn't happen again. But anyway, so I started, I wanted to be as fully Christian as possible. I started going to this Protestant church. As soon as I knew the pastor a little bit, I kind of shyly asked him, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And when he answered without the respect that I knew that she deserved, I knew this was no place for me. And the other thing that was happening in those days was I was spending all my free time hanging out at Marian shrines. And in particular, there was a shrine to Our Lady of La Salette, not far from my house. Our Lady of La Salette was a Marian apparition high in the French Alps. It's, by the way, totally church approved. High in the French Alps in 1846, it was a one-time apparition. The Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to a couple of shepherd children, a little bit like Fatima. And there was a model of the original shrine near my house. I used to go there three or four times a week just to walk the grounds and to kind of feel the presence of the Blessed Virgin Mary and commune with her. And then the next winter I was...
I'm going to interrupt the witness testimony there because I had more time when I was giving it at the parish than we have right now. The hour will soon come to an end. To cut to the chase, so to speak, to cut to the finish line, obviously... given that I was in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary, and perhaps even more centrally, that I knew from that experience that I had with her, the role she played. I understood from that experience directly that she was the intermediary between the divinity and humanity, that although, as she said, she was just a creature, that she was nothing, that God was everything, nonetheless, I saw how all of the graces that flow from the Godhead into humankind flow through the Blessed Virgin Mary. And that understanding and that certainty of that knowledge led me pretty directly into the Catholic Church, at which point I was baptized and have since obviously maintained that conviction. This all took place. It's probably pushing 30 years ago, maybe slightly under 30 years ago. And it certainly hasn't been compromised, I hope. So because when it happened, you know, for instance, my parents, who, of course, were still Jewish, were very upset. And they were hoping that I would grow out of it or, you know, that it was a passing phase. So it definitely wasn't a passing phase, thank God. Let me just close the show. I only have about two or three more minutes. So I thought I'd close the show with a couple of quotes from other Jews who entered the Catholic Church. Because, of course, from our perspective, that is of Jews in the Catholic Church, this isn't a conversion. We went from being Jews who had failed to recognize the Jewish Messiah when he came to Jews who did recognize the Jewish Messiah and who became followers of the Jewish Messiah. So, in fact, we were just basically going from Jews who had missed the boat to Jews who jumped on the boat and we're sailing with it in the presence of the Jewish Messiah. So rather than having stopped being Jewish, we actually, I will argue, became more Jewish than ever. And that is the universal understanding of Jews who have entered the church. So let me read a short quote from Cardinal Archbishop Lustiger, who was the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris until he passed away a few years ago. He was a Jewish convert. And he recounts that... I'll directly quote from him now. I explained to my father that baptism would not make me abandon my Jewish condition. Quite the contrary. It would lead me to find it, to receive the fullness of its meaning. I did not have the feeling that I was betraying my heritage or abandoning anything whatsoever, just the opposite. I felt that I was going to find the import, the meaning of what I had received at birth. I did nothing more than begin to enjoy the heritage that had been promised to me. Amen. So that's why the show is called Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, because he was the Promised Messiah of Judaism. And as back to Lustiger, Christianity is the continuation of Judaism. Christianity is the fruit of Judaism. Until the Messiah's coming in glory, the Jew remains, and he remains a Jew, whether he is Christian or not. And that's why, pedantically speaking, I consider myself a Jew in the Catholic Church. And however, I am incredibly grateful to, needless to say, the Catholic Church and to the majority of the Catholic Church, who are Gentiles, for having kept the flame burning for those 2,000 years until I got on the right boat. So with that, let me sign off for today. You've been listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. You've been listening to Roy Shoman, your host, a grateful and enthusiastic, I hope, Jewish entrant into the Catholic Church. At the very start of the show, I mentioned that I am leading a pilgrimage, a fundamentally Catholic pilgrimage, to the Holy Land in April. If you're interested in more details, the email address is haveroytalk@gmail.com. And with that, I'll say goodbye, and I hope you join us again next week on Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. Bye for now.